David Cassidy.
Yes.
Growing up, 60s America, he's a bit jet lagged, we should say. David
70s, Cassidy, 80s.
Mm, 70s, 80s. Good.
90s. Where are we now? Good God.
Growing up at some stage, early vivid memories?
Yes, I was in Manhattan. I grew up in New York. And I remember my father and my mother, we lived in an apartment in lower Manhattan. They took me out to my grandparents. I was probably three. And we were out in a... It's odd because it was the first time I'd been out in the country. Probably three and a half. And I remember my father and I chasing one another. And I remember I was running as fast as I could run. And my father, there were trees in between us and we were in our bathing suits. And I remember I was trying so hard and my father was outrunning me. And basically, I spent the next 23 years trying to outrun him. And sadly, he passed away before I ever could. Oh. So that was my earliest memory. I'm sure it was rather dull for those of you out there listening. But
I think it's riveting, actually. I'd spend the entire hour on that one, David.
Well, we might.
Well, let's turn to David Cassidy, whose journey was in the opposite direction. Here's Simon Russell Beale showing himself off as a superb high baritone. And David started out as an actor and got lured into being one of the hottest teen pop idols of the 70s.
They didn't lure me, actually.
Well, you're...
it just, they didn't lure me because I wouldn't have taken the bait. What happened was they put a ball and chain around my... leg, and they dropped me in the ocean. They said, you're going whether you like it or not. I was an actor. I'd worked in the theater. I'd worked on Broadway for a year after I graduated from high school. I was the only non-professional actor working with the L.A. Theater Company in 1968-7. And at 18, I graduated from high school. And 2 weeks after I moved back to New York, which was my plan from the time I was three and a half. And my father and my stepmother, Shirley, were doing a musical, and they had rented a little house in Westchester County right outside. And I got a job in a mailroom for $2 an hour. And I was studying. I studied probably about 6 months, I would say. And... It was a kind of difficult time because I had no friends, and I had come out of the tumultuous 60s in the Southern California, which was kind of mecca for the social and sexual revolution.
You were a heavily self-indulgent. I should say you have your autobiography out, Could It Be Forever? And you do portray yourself as a heavily self-indulgent teen.
I think without a lot of guidance, because my parents were both my mother and my stepfather, who was married to my mother at the time, was a director, doing quite well. He directed a lot of the early Playhouse 90s and Omnibus, and then he did Cat Ballou, a great comedy film he directed, and then A Man Called Horse. Anyway, he was constantly working, and my mother was very narcissistic, and my father was never around. So I did pretty much what I wanted to do. Not a lot of guidance, but I knew what I wanted to do. So I went back to New York. I took this part-time job. I studied with David Craig. I was very fortunate to have been around some wonderful actors. My father had a great impact on me. My book is very, very much the journey in which my father left us at three and a half, 4, 5 years old, and I moved back out where I was discussing earlier to New Jersey and lived with my grandparents in a very, very modest. I come from real working class Irish. They came over during the potato famine. Anyway, people assumed I grew up in Hollywood. They assumed I was a son of a movie star. They assumed I was all of those things, which, you know, on the surface, what we were talking about earlier, it was that there is no way I could ever see myself as other people saw me.
No.
I always just thought I was just one of the boys. Mm. And then I became... something else, because I was just an actor, and my first role was on Broadway. The show closed, and a fellow from CBS Films brought me to L.A. I did a screen test. I didn't get the movie. I was too young looking, And they showed the screen test around to his things to happen. And then I did all of these guest starring roles on dramatic shows on television, Ironsides and Marcus Welby and Bonanza. And I played
You're
a killer.
Bonanza.
a killer. I played all of those roles. I'd never done a half-hour sitcom. Yeah. And at the end of the year, I became this hot young actor. And because I grew up playing guitar and singing, and I, much like you, I had a lot of, I'd sang in the choir when I was with my grandparents. I was the soloist all the time, and I was always the singer, and that, you know, it wasn't anything.
So you got the Partridge Family, so
yeah,
which made you this
as an actor. They never asked me if I could sing.
But then there's a wonderful moment in the book where you were wary of kind of taking the whole sort of career on.
I didn't
you
want
said,
to be.
I want to be a respected working actor, which was your father's line.
Exactly.
And someone says to you, "Be a respected working superstar instead."
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Sold your soul, really.
I did. And you know, at 19, my father had such an impact on me that he said, because this is how he worked, and you can relate to this. Every actor fears that this is they're going to they'll find me out. They're going to find me out. Yeah. I can't do this, or I can't do that, or this is the end of my career. Mm-hmm. This is be my last job. Mm-hmm. Well, when you're supporting yourself at 19 years old, and I don't care how meager the digs are, but I was able to, from all those shows I told you about, in 1 year, support myself solely as an actor. I never worked as a waiter. Mm. And that was a great accomplishment for me. Mm. And I felt very proud, so I took every job I could. So
when you became the David Cassidy that grew out of the Partridge Family and became the pop star,
mm-hmm.
you're very interesting on the business of being that famous. Mm. We hear this quite often, but I've hardly ever read it quite so convincingly as in your book. Mm. Here you are with your long floppy hair and your angel face and everybody screaming at you day and night. Mm. But you say you had almost no friends for yourself, and you have this meeting with Elvis, and you look at Elvis and think that's you in 15 years and...
Or 10.
And the fear.
Well,
he
was at a stage where it was after the comeback, and he'd been back out touring, and he was starting to gain weight. And there was a sadness in his face and his eyes that I recognized, because he acknowledged me as being the biggest thing since him to me. And that kind of scared me. Because I can remember growing up as a little boy when I was 5 and 6 and everybody out on the street when I was just a little kid, and that's all they would do is talk about Elvis and you know, Elvis is a fag, Elvis is this, he's a gay, he's a, you know, all these things. And I realized, of course, those conversations were taking place about me, and I was well aware of it. But when I looked at him, he had in his house, he had a belt that it was given to him, a big gold gaudy belt that was, he hung it over his bed. And I thought this was the saddest thing I'd ever seen. He sold his soul to the devil because the movies he made, he was actually an aspiring young actor. And the same agent that he had named Lenny Hershon, who picked him up the first time he got off an airplane at LAX in Los Angeles, became my film agent, who did basically the same thing for my film career that he did for Elvis, except his manager, the Colonel, made a deal for Elvis for 20 years to make 20 bad movies. Mm. I mean, he has to live with Clambake and do the clam. Now, I am only fortunate enough that my career in the Partridge Family, although as much impact as it had, and I became all of that, I was able to stop at the top. The last concert I did was at Main Road, and I played White City Stadium before. I'd been all over the world, and I stopped.
Well, yeah, there was this extraordinary turning point.
Well, I'd seen it in Elvis a year before and said, that's it. This is my last year. I know.
But you kind of hid for 6 years, didn't you, from 74 to 80?
I didn't go out of my room for 18 months.
Wow.
Really?
I mean it.
So you weren't just hiding among good, close friends. You were really very isolated.
I had two friends. Two very close friends. I had someone, a housekeeper, who took care of me. Mm. And I was incredibly lost.
How old were you then?
25. Mm. And understand, the most famous guy in the world, the biggest fan club in the world. Mm. I had worked 18 hours a day, all day on a television show, recorded as the Partridge Family, recorded as David Cassidy, and on the weekends I would go and tour. You tell me how I'm going to have a life. I can't walk down the street. Mm. I have 30 people traveling with me on my own.
John Lennon gave you a hint on how to walk down the street.
John talked a lot with me. Yeah, he became my mentor. In fact, he came over to my house on New Year's Eve, 1974-5, and he was very drunk. And I had a couple of friends of mine, Susan Day, who was in the Partridge Family with me, and a mutual friend, and we'd been drinking tequila. And John came in about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we started chatting. I'd met him a couple times before, but we went into my music room, and we started playing. And I got to fulfill, although I was drunk as a skunk. We both were. New Year's Eve, it's an amateur night, so you get that one. But I started reteaching him the early stuff that on the guitar that he had written, that I had learned when I was 13, that he had forgotten because he'd written so many great ones. So I retaught him
His old song.
His old song, and I got to sing Paul's parts. Whoa. Now, if that isn't for a guy who was 13 when they broke, and I went out and bought an electric guitar the next day, that was like, mammoth for me. Just to be able to do that.
But what did he advise you about walking?
He advised me about we talked about demystification.
Yeah.
Which is what he had been trying to do since 1970. Yeah. And he was the most committed man I've ever known in my life to something that he believed in that was the antithesis of what people saw him as, which is his peace-loving, funny guy. Mm. He was the most serious man about peace. Mm. About spreading love, about how we as a human race need to coexist. Mm-hmm. And he was dead committed to it and took so much flack. People forget about the bed-in when he and Yoko.
That's right,
the
yes.
press were just all over him. Like he was, And he was a great mentor for me and a friend. And I miss his voice. Mm-hmm. I still have the politics in my head of it's a dirty word in America. I know what it's like. But I am a liberal who really believes socially, if not probably physically more of a conservative, but socially definitely a liberal. And I miss his voice because he was willing to go to the wall and say, I will stand here. I will stop eating until you recognize what this voice is. Mm. And I'm sorry to go on, but he had a great impact on me.
What about this demystification? Yeah.
Well, the demystification was you have to be willing and be brave. And you have to be willing to just be a human being again. You can't stay in your room.
But is it sort of like your identity has been robbed by the public?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. No. Yeah. By the media.
Yeah.
By the television, the character I played on television.
Yeah.
I played a character 16 years old. I was 21, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
I'd already hitched up to the hate. That wasn't the boy I played on television.
Well, the story's in this book, Could It Be Forever, which is a great title, except it's made me sing that song over and over again. It's in my head. It drives me insane, David. I don't forget.